It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Our next segment definitely falls into the category of what the kids are up to these days, and by kids we mean kids, grown-ups, and lots of people in between.
Video games get a lot of heat sometimes for allegedly turning players into mindless zombies, but our next guest says the game Minecraft is one of the most creative video games ever made.
Aaron Yanda is with us here in the studio. He's the creator of the popular web series Chad Vader and runs Game Society Films, a humorous gaming review channel on YouTube. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So if you're into video games, you know, you probably already know all about the Minecraft phenomenon. But if you don't, Aaron, start us off by telling us what Minecraft is.
Well, it's a lot of things, but the simple version is it has a retro feel. It's a video game where you take blocks and you mine them, and then you can build things or you can have adventures. It's kind of up to you. It has a lot of flexibility.
And you call this a real creativity-boosting video game, maybe the most creative ever made. Why?
I think because it's almost like, you know, an artist has their tools, and in this video game, you can use these blocks as your tools, and you can build whatever you want, whatever you can imagine. You can build things from popular culture, from books. People do this all the time.
What are some of the crazy things people have built?
One of the coolest things I've seen, being a Game of Thrones fan, is they've remade everything in Game of Thrones, but one of the coolest things is King's Landing, just made in incredible detail. I'm pretty sure that a lot of people spent a lot of time doing that. Harry Potter I've seen. One of the cooler things that I found recently was someone built a computer in Minecraft, like a simple functioning computer in a computer.
You sent that to me today.
Yes.
and I watched it and I turned to Rob and said, I don't get it. How does it work?
It's
kind of mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing. It's sort of confusing, but I mean, so, you know, you can do anything. So, like, obviously someone who's extremely brilliant made this computer in the game, and I have no idea what that means. It could mean anything, but I was just amazed by that. But I mean, obviously, you can work with other people in concert, like making things in the game, or you can just play the game by yourself. You can, you know, fight the monsters. There are zombies in the game, and build yourself a shelter and just try to, you know, keep the monsters out at night when they come out to try to get you.
So a weird thing about this game and about its success, it seems like the holy grail in video games is the awesomest, most detailed graphics, the most beautiful images, and that is what Minecraft is not. Talk about what the game looks like.
It has these sort of low-res blocks that make it look like an older video game. Mm-hmm. But that's really what gives it its charm. And so what's kind of neat is when people take those blocks and they make really amazingly visual, complex things that you just wouldn't expect to see in the game, and then sometimes they don't. I mean, you can build rail systems, you can build all these things, or you can just play it in a simple way, I know a lot of kids play it, so you don't have to, you know, do all this stuff, but you have the option. And so I think that brings a lot of different people from different areas into the game, and that's why it's so popular.
What do we know about the guy who built this thing?
His name is Marcus Notch Pearson. He's Swedish. I'm not exactly sure if that's how you pronounce his last name. I just call him Notch because I think that's what everybody calls him. So
it's like you don't win this. It's a sandbox. It's like you don't win playing with Legos, right?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, well, they put out an expansion recently where you can sort of win the game. You fight a dragon and you go on this adventure. But, you know, that's for people who want to do that. If you just want to, you know, make something that looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright house, you can do that. It's actually really easy. I have my own house in the game, kind of looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright house. So,
interesting.
Yes.
I'm sure Frank would be thrilled.
I think he would.
Well, one of the interesting aspects about this game is that it's moved beyond the game into kind of a cultural phenomenon. Today, our producer Chris Molina was pointing out that Minecraft Halloween costumes are really big this year with these big blocky heads. And there are lots of songs that people have done about Minecraft as well. This is one which is a knockoff of Katy Perry's song. This one is called Don't Mine at Night.
Don't mind at night. I know you're looking at that cave and you're feeling kind of brave. Go to bed, you'll be alright. Don't mind at night. There's nothing that is gonna change if you just wait.
So what happens at night, Aaron?
That is when the monsters come out. The creepers, the skeletons, the zombies. The creepers are the worst because when they get close to you, they explode and they blow up like wherever you're standing around. So if they get into your house and you've spent, you know, half a day creating this house, they can blow up, you know, half your house and you'll have to spend another day fixing everything.
The freaks come out at night, as the old song said. But you don't have to play it that way, right? If you don't want to have to deal with all the survival and you just want to make cool stuff, you can just say, no monsters, thank you.
Yeah, you can play it on creative mode. And so then there is no monsters, you can't die, and you can just do whatever you want. For example, you know, recreate the entire landscape of Game of Thrones. But one of the main things of the game is mining. And especially if you're playing it on Xbox, you do a lot of mining. And you're just kind of, you know, tapping away at the ground, collecting different types of resources. I liken it to... in Anna Karenina, which I don't know if you're familiar.
Yes. Are you about to make an Anna Karenina Minecraft analogy?
Yes, I am.
The book has inspired so many video games.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? I bet the world of Anna Karenina is recreated in Minecraft. But, you know, when Levin is threshing the wheat, he gets into this meditative state. And I liken the mining in Minecraft to the same kind of thing. Of course, it's not in reality. But you're just, you know, you're going at the blocks. You keep mining and mining and mining. And it's kind of awesome.
I can't believe you just did that.
Yeah, thank you.
That's
you.
That was beautiful.
And so is the game. It can be really relaxing as well as, like, creative and fun, etc.
I don't think I've gotten to the heights of artistry that you're talking about. I've tried to play it with my son, and every time I get eaten by a blob in 30 seconds, and I can't quite figure out how to make the leap. What if someone wants to play it? What do you suggest for taking your baby Minecraft steps?
Well, I would say if you don't want to get eaten right away, just play it on creative mode for a little bit. Practice mining. Get some resources, you know, build a couple of basic things, ask your kids how to build things.
Apparently.
and just start slow and have fun.
All right, excellent. Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Aaron Yonda. He runs Game Society Films, a humorous gaming review channel on YouTube, and he's also the co-creator of the popular web series Chad Vader.
The National Security Administration's spying saga has taken yet another new turn. Now, former supporters of surveillance programs are coming out against it, or at least some aspects of what the NSA is doing, including Wisconsin Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, who co-authored the Patriot Act, and Senator Dianne Feinstein of California.
And a group of lawmakers has authored a new bill to reform the NSA. And we want to know what you think about this surveillance program. Is it necessary for U.S. security, or is it a violation of our rights, and why? How would you like to see the NSA reformed? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Kurt Opsahl joins us now. He's senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Kurt, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
So among the other pieces of news in the last couple of days, as we mentioned, a lot of lawmakers, including Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, turning against the NSA, so in some cases, people who have defended it for a long time. Are you surprised by this turnaround?
I think, as the more information has come clear about what the NSA has been doing and how much the Congress has been informed or hasn't been informed, as this becomes more clear, it's not surprising that there'll be less and less support.
And what kind of changes are you expecting in this new bill introduced by Representative Sensenbrenner in the House, Senator Patrick Leahy in the Senate? What would change for the NSA?
Well, the new bill just came out today. It's a positive first step, and it's got a lot of great attributes in it, but we're actually still in the process of analyzing it. So we just want to make sure, though, as we look at it, that the government can't distort it, as they have with some other language, to allow for bulk collection. But that's certainly what Leahy and Sensenbrenner are trying to do, is stop bulk collection.
Well, let's talk about that bulk collection you mentioned, revelations from the Edward Snowden leaks coming out for months now, including massive data collection from phone records, online records. What to you is most worrisome about that big data collection from the NSA?
Well, I think it's the unconstitutionality that really is the worst, that we have we're a nation of laws. We set up a constitution that was designed to be a check on executive power and what Congress can authorize, and to authorize, both for Congress to try and authorize and the executive to go even beyond that for warrantless surveillance of millions of ordinary Americans is quite disturbing.
That's been one of the arguments here, back and forth, what the NSA has been doing. People have been saying is legal under the Patriot Act, but you're saying that Congress exceeded its authority in making that legal?
Well, I mean, I think actually it's both illegal and unconstitutional. I mean, it's unconstitutional in that it goes beyond the Fourth Amendment. It actually has a chilling effect on First Amendment protected activities. But in addition, the interpretation of the Patriot Act is ludicrous.
How do you see this hurting us on a daily basis? You mentioned it's chilling. It hurts our privacy. Why should the average American be worried about this?
Well, privacy is really about the right to be left alone, to be able to go about your affairs without the government looking over your shoulder, seeing everything that you do, and be able to take some of these things out of context or doing things to make you look bad. I mean, one of the things we saw from some of the recent leaks was a practice apparently common enough that they had a nickname for it called LoveInt, a play on words on SIGINT, which is for signals intelligence. LoveInt was when NSA analysts were checking out what was going on with their ex-lovers, their former boyfriends and girlfriends, using these spying superpowers.
That's a case of individual abuse there, but defenders from within the NSA, within the American intelligence community, say we may not like it, but we need this. We need to go sorting through all this data to help prevent terrorist attacks, one of which could be very devastating if we don't prevent it.
Well, I mean, first of all, invoking the mantra of national security is not a skeleton key that unlocks the Constitution. The Constitution is a document that protects us all, and that's actually what the government should be fighting to defend. But even if you take that on its own terms, they have not made a particularly credible case that these programs have been very effective. At first, when trying to defend the surveillance program, they said, it was helpful in 54 circumstances. And after some questioning, they dropped that number down to 12 or so circumstances. And then after further questioning investigation, they dropped that down to 2. And now they're kind of relying mostly on one circumstance, which was that somebody was trying to send $5,000 to somebody in Somalia.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Jake with us in Milwaukee. Jake, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I think it's just a lesson that no matter what your ideology is, being liberal, conservative, or whatever, that there is, as your guest is saying, there is a separation of powers, and that no matter who's in office at the time when the legislature gives away their oversight power to the executive branch, it's just going to concentrate it, and it's just going to be abused. So, I mean, it's happening in this state and other states, and it's happening on the federal level, and I think it just really needs to be brought back. And the ideological, political, as in party sides of it, needs to be taken away. It needs to be looked at a constitutional level. So that's all I got to say.
All right. Thanks for the call, Jake. Kurt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point. I mean, the opposition to the NSA surveillance program has been bipartisan. As you can see, the bill that was introduced today was from the Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy and Republican Congressman Sensenbrenner. And Sensenbrenner actually was one of the authors of the Patriot Act. He's no weak-kneed liberal, as you might say. He's been a strong supporter of the NSA until he found out that they were abusing the powers and going beyond it. So I think there is a lot of actually bipartisan to this, and it really is not the traditional party divides.
How worried are you about the transparency in particular? Not so much what the NSA is doing, but what we know about what the NSA is doing.
You know, one of the greatest sort of challenges here has been the lack of transparency, especially about secret law, is that in a secret court, the FISA court, that meets in a electronically and sound shielded room that no one can get access to, they were interpreting the meaning of the law. And the law, you know, in this case, was saying that things had to be relevant to an authorized investigation. And on the basis of the phrase relevant, they decided that every single phone call of everybody in America all the time was relevant to an investigation. And that, you know, there's no difference between that and not having the word relevant in the statute. It's an extreme interpretation of the law. But we had no idea that interpretation existed because it was done in a secret court and the legal opinion was classified. Secret law is anathema to a free society.
We're talking to Kurt Opsahl. He's senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, talking about the NSA and a turn in Congress. People used to be defending the NSA, now saying, hey, we need a law to restrict and have more transparency in their surveillance programs.
And what do you think? Do you think Congress should limit the surveillance powers of the NSA? And how would you like to see the NSA reformed? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or post your thoughts on our Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farag. We continue our conversation about the National Security Agency and surveillance with Kurt Opsahl from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Some of the latest news, a group of people in Congress, both houses, are introducing a law to reform what the NSA can do.
And we're welcoming your calls now. Do you think Congress should act to limit the powers of the NSA? What do you think of recent news about NSA surveillance showing that the agency is out of control? Do you agree with that? Or do you think they're doing something that actually needs to be done for national security? What is your take? And how would you like to see the NSA reformed? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also speak your mind on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Sean on the line in Madison. Sean, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, good show. As always, fantastic guest. I just wanted to make a quick observation. I was listening to On Point this morning on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network, and I heard their guest was quoting the lovely representative Mike Rogers, who is basically chastising Europe in general for not appreciating the fact that we're listening to other conversations or all this metadata. And he kept stating over and over again, and I've been reading this, that they're not listening to content. They're not recording content. They're just getting metadata. And that makes me think of two things. Number one, I bet they're lying. And number two, even if they're not, gathering all this data, they're getting their foot. It's like the camel getting its nose in the tent. They will be listening to content. And if they don't see, and everyone keeps saying, this is not Orwellian. We're not spying on our citizens. But they don't see, they're missing the whole point of literature and metaphor, which is that, yes, they're moving in that direction. It's just a matter of time. And by the time they get there, we will have already conceded the fact that they shouldn't be doing it in the first place. So I'll take comments while I'm off the phone. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Thanks for the call. Sean, Kurt, that distinction, is it okay if they track metadata, who's calling who and when, versus actually recording and listening in on phone calls?
You know, metadata is extraordinarily intrusive. It is actually, it's easier for them to develop a profile about you by analyzing your metadata than to listen on your phone calls. To listen to the phone calls for a human, that's incredibly time-consuming. To have a machine do it, they have to, you know, sort through accents, different, you know, low-quality connections, try and figure out what you said. But looking at your metadata, they can get the patterns of your life. They know when you're sleeping and when you're awake, by what times you're making calls and using the internet. They know if you're in a relationship with somebody because of the frequency of calls, the duration, and the time that they have. If you were then calling up places like Planned Parenthood, they have some idea of what's going on in your life, or if you're calling an HIV testing center. By looking at the metadata, they have a far more complete picture of the intimate details of your life. than virtually anything that the world has ever seen. So to say it's just metadata really is just trying to dodge the issue.
Thanks for the call, Sean. I'll go back to the phones in just a moment. Kurt, I wanted to ask, at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, you're involved in legal cases related to the NSA. What kind of challenges are you raising in particular?
Absolutely. So we're involved in two cases against the NSA right now. One of them is challenging the collection of your data as under the Fourth Amendment, under you know, the statutes themselves, saying it goes beyond the statutes. And the other is adding a new First Amendment angle to it, where we're representing a variety of associations who want to have their member lists private, but the NSA is able to obtain them by seeing the phone records of who they call and who they're in touch with.
All right, we'll go back to the phones now. Rick is with us in Grafton. Rick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is probably an unpopular one. I think times have changed somewhat since the Constitution, obviously, and I think that machines, I've been in technology 30 years, and I think that they could make it so that a human isn't needed unless the conversation turns threatening. Now, I know there's some challenges there, but voice recognition software is making huge leaps and bounds, and I think that kind of like the telephone equipment's listening to our conversations, but we don't really care. To allow the artificial intelligence to listen and then flag any type of suspicious activity.
All right, thanks for the call, Rick. I don't know if it, I won't say it's popular or unpopular, but Rick is definitely not alone in making that argument, Kurt.
Well, I mean, it comes down to do you trust the people who are making this AI? Do you trust them to have them do it properly? It's all about trust us. So even if it's computers that are listening in, it's the people who program it, who decide what the computers are listening for, that you have to trust to decide to do the right thing with the information. And one of the things that is part of our Constitution, I think has been an important part in the last 200 years, is the notion that the people shouldn't have to trust the government, but we set up checks and balances to ensure that we don't have a tyrannical government, that one that overreaches. So it's not good sort of hygiene of a civic society to create the powers that could be tremendously misused.
So are there cases where the NSA should be listening to someone, tracking their metadata? And if so, what kind of checks and balances would you want to see in place when that happens?
You know, so the last time the NSA very publicly got out of hand and started exceeding their authority, this led to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of the 1970s. And that was designed to limit what they were doing to spy on the spies. The term was agent of a foreign power. And so it followed a process which would enable them to conduct surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes on agents of foreign powers. And that was successful for some time in reigning in the NSA, but of course now we've gone far beyond that.
And so what would you like to go back to the model
that
worked then?
Yeah, go back to a model where the NSA is restricted in its ability to surveil, to bulk collection, to surveil on innocent civilians, instead are focusing on agents of a foreign power.
We'll go back to callers now. We have Drew with us in La Crosse. Drew, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a distinction that previous callers actually already made the difference between collecting metrics and collecting data. When it comes to collecting metrics, you're collecting, for example, someone's eye color, and the data would be everything about someone. And in the business world, we've been doing this for since big data became a concept. And it is a really powerful thing. We can collect patterns about people, determine facets of their life that you can't see just by examining one phone call. For example, through Target's limited system, 2012, they had an issue where their automatic metric system was able to determine someone was pregnant before the father found out, because of what products they searched, and comparing that to registry of women who have signed up for baby showers on their website. It's really kind of powerful things, and it definitely is something that, as technology gets more and more advanced and the ability to collect data for cheaper and cheaper rises, something that needs to be addressed and limited, because it can't completely capture someone's life. All right, I'm going to hang up on this one now.
Thanks for the call, Drew. Kurt, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean the metrics are very important. It can be very invasive if people are using these metrics. And one of the things that you know it comes up in these debates is, well, you know, if companies are being able to collect all this information, well, why shouldn't the government? And the important distinction is that the companies can't put you in jail. They don't have the police power. They don't have this kind of the authority that a government does. And that's why we have to be extra careful about when the government can have access to this kind of very invasive data.
Kurt, before we're done, a lot of what we've talked about relates to domestic surveillance, American citizens. A lot of the revelations from Edward Snowden's documents relate to foreign leaders, among others. Is that something you're tracking at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and something you're worried about?
Absolutely. We also are concerned about people throughout the world and that ordinary civilians of all stripes are being surveilled under these programs instead of a more focused program that is looking at agents of a foreign power. But even when they have been looking at, political figures of foreign powers, what we've seen lately is that 35 world leaders of people who were supposedly allies of the United States have been surveilled, and this has caused major diplomatic incidents, ongoing right now. And one of the things we recently learned was that Obama is saying he was not aware that the NSA was surveilling some of these leaders.
All right, Kurt, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
All right, my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Kurt Opsahl, Senior Staff Attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Coming up next, we're talking to an author of a book on the photographic history of the war in Vietnam. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
We're taking a look back at the war in Vietnam as told through photographs from the Associated Press. It's said that the world knew and saw more of the war in Vietnam than any other war before or since. And that's in part due to the work of war photographers on the ground in the heart of the conflict throughout the Vietnam War.
And no news source did more to document the war than the Associated Press.
And here with us now is Hal Buell. He was director of the photography at the Associated Press for 25 years, including during the Vietnam War era. And he's with us to talk about the new book, Vietnam, The Real War, a photographic history by the Associated Press. Hal, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Veronica.
Well, what was it about the war in Vietnam that at that time gave such unprecedented access to the sites and the news from the war?
Well, there were the circumstances surrounding coverage of the war was unique until that time and frankly remains unique since. The photographers had great access through the rides on helicopters. There was no censorship, and anybody with a press pass could get on a helicopter. So if a photographer picked up word that there was a battle in Kuchi or up north near the DMZ or up in Pleiku in the mountains, he just went out to the airport and asked what pilot was headed that way with supplies or medical supplies and asked permission to jump on board. And if the pilot said yes, off he went. And it was just a really open season for photographers.
So it was unprecedented sort of mobility. Nowadays, I suppose they have to get a lot of permissions and go through lots of bureaucratic hoops. Is that right?
Well, the issues now resolve around two things. One, the process of embedding a photographer, which locks a photographer into one unit for whatever the period of embed is. So a photographer could sign up for a week or 10 days with a unit. If the unit did nothing, the photographer was locked into that unit and couldn't move. So if a battle took place on the other side of the mountain or the other side of the county or area, there was no way to get there. Whereas in Vietnam, if a photographer went on a patrol and the patrol turned out to be nothing, he could just hop his way back and hop on a helicopter to go somewhere else where there might be some action. So it was a freedom of movement. Now, freedom of movement in Iraq and Afghanistan was not as easy. It was a very dangerous thing. Murders and assassinations and kidnappings of media increased greatly during those two conflicts. And so it was a little dangerous to be out there all alone. Dangerous enough in Vietnam, but at least you had the protection of the military, where if you went off alone in Iraq or Afghanistan, you didn't have that safety. So those two factors tended to restrict or dampen the coverage.
Now, it sounds like a lot of the photographs that eventually made the papers and really transformed the way the public saw the war in Vietnam, sounds like a lot of those photographs crossed your desk. Is that right?
That's correct. My responsibility was the distribution of pictures in the United States and the collection of pictures in the United States and from around the world. So those pictures came in from Vietnam on really shaky radio photo circuits, and we were able to retransmit them into the U.S., but we also went through original film that was shipped very quickly to New York to get original pictures that we transmitted on the networks.
Now, as you were seeing these photographs and some film as it came in, did you know that these photographs were special? Did you know you were seeing something that had the power to change the country?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I was familiar with the Korean War coverage and familiar by study of World War II coverage. And there was a difference. You could see the difference in the pictures very early on. It were closer to the fighting troops. In the early part of the war, it was a Vietnamese war, and the Vietnamese face that was on the war. But you got very close to it, and you saw some of the horrible things that happened in war that you never did see from Korea, sometimes because of censorship, but sometimes because it just didn't happen that way. The nature of the war was different, and photographers were able to photograph that, thanks again to the access they had, and were able to get to battles while they were still going on, as opposed to getting there in some other way. It was slower.
One of the things that surprised me a bit, I suppose it shouldn't have, but when I looked at your book, those photographs, they are still, they're like dynamite. They go off in your head and you can't get the image out of there. They're powerful. Even all these years later, you know, Vietnam is well behind us. We're fighting new wars, but they're still so potent. Why do you think that is?
I think that's because they are so close to the humanity that was involved in the war. Also, you have to bear in mind that the people fighting in Vietnam were draftees, and they were not regular army, and they tended to be a little more bare-chested and open with correspondence. Also, the GIs and Marines that were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan were regular army. They were all enlisted. And they were equipped with all sorts of technological devices with strange gimmicks on their helmets and goggles and weapons that we hadn't seen before. And they had a kind of a, I hate to say this, but they had a robotic feel to them that was not as visceral or flesh and blood as the kinds of things we saw in Vietnam. And of course, 58,000 Americans died in Vietnam. And as bad as the fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan was, the fatalities were not close to that number.
I want to talk about a couple of the photographs that a lot of people remember. One is from 1963. It's the image of a monk who has set himself on fire, I guess, with gasoline, and his body is being consumed, and he's sitting there in a meditation posture. You know, it's hard for your brain to take something like that in. What can you tell us about the backstory of that picture?
Well, that picture was made by Mal Brown, who is a writer, not a photographer, by the way. But Mal had very close connections with the Buddhist community. And at that time, the Buddhists were in a out-and-out struggle with the government over their lack of attention from the government, since the government was run mostly by Roman Catholics. And they had a series of protests, and Mal covered them all, and he was tipped off the night before that there was going to be an especially dramatic protest the next morning. So Mal joined the monks at the temple and marched with them to the city and witnessed this immolation. What's important about that picture is that until that picture appeared, the war in Vietnam was kind of a page 10 or 10 or page 12 story. But that picture put the story on the front page, and where it stayed for 10 years. It also ended up on John Kennedy's desk the next morning, and he inquired of Henry Cabot Lodge, who was his newly appointed ambassador to Vietnam, to say, what the hell's going on out there? Let's find out. And as it turned out, the picture was made in June. In November, there was a coup d'etat in which President Ngo Dinh Diem was killed.
And I suppose the monk in that picture died.
He did indeed. He died right there on the street. And his heart was entombed in a chalice in the temple. I wish I could tell you whether it's still there. I tried to find out whether his heart is still located there, but I, so far, have been unable to determine that.
Well, one of the most well-known photographs from the war is called Napalm Girl. It's by Nick Ut, or Ut. And I wonder, you know, a lot of us have heard that story, but not from your mouth. Could you tell us about what happened that day?
Well, there had been several days of struggle between North Vietnamese troops and South Vietnamese troops around a town called Tra Bang, and some of the people had taken coverage in a temple, a Khao Dai temple, which is a kind of a cult religion. And during the course of the fight, Nick Ut had driven, it's about 25 miles from Saigon, and Nick Ut had driven in his van to as close as they could get to the actual fighting. And the South Vietnamese called in an airstrike, and South Vietnamese pilots in their planes came over the temple and dropped napalm, but it was misdirected. Somehow they got their longitude and latitude confused, and napalm landed among some Vietnamese civilians who were seriously burned, and they ran down the highway away, of course, from the blast toward where the, of course, there were the little cortege of correspondents and photographers there, and Nick made the picture as the young girl ran towards him, and Nick, being Nick, saw she was very seriously hurt. He put down his camera and he took her to the van that AP had nearby and drove her to a hospital. And Nick and Kim Phuc, that was the girl's name, became very close friends, and they are in touch even today. She now lives in Toronto. But the picture, of course, being as dramatic as it was, became a great anti-war symbol, not a political symbol, but just a symbol of how innocents are caught in the horrors of war, and it just taken on a great anti-war feeling.
Did a photo like that, a photo that became that famous and changed so many hearts or touched so many hearts, did that change that now woman's life?
Oh, absolutely. She was sent to Cuba to be trained as a dental technician, and she met the man she eventually married and took off. They were married and were given a honeymoon trip to Moscow. And when she came back, the plane stopped in Toronto, and she and her husband got off the plane and sought a political asylum, which they were given. And she is now she now operates a company that lobbies for the innocents who are caught in war. She's really quite well known and travels and speaks very effectively on behalf of peace and the need to obviously the need to avoid wars that do damage like this to innocents.
We've only got about a minute left, but is there something, Hal, special about the photograph? We have a lot of technology at our fingertips now, including, you know, videos and all kinds of things, really quick-snapped cell phone shots, which aren't quite the same as what we're seeing out of the Vietnam War. What's special about the photograph?
Well, the photograph itself, I always kind of compare photographs to kind of a history's notebook, because when you look at a picture like the pictures you see in this book, like Nick Ut's picture and the Saigon execution made by Eddie Adams, where the man was executed in a Saigon street, those pictures, they open up a window and they recollect things that happened before. They certainly recollect the incident that took place, and they frequently give us an indication of what's coming down the line in the future, and they really become landmarks, historical landmarks that help us relate visually and viscerally to historical events that sometimes get lost in a mass of words that are sometimes useful and sometimes not so useful.
All right. Well, Hal, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
That was Hal Buell, former director of photography at the Associated Press, talking about the new book, Vietnam, The Real War, A Photographic History by the Associated Press.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.